Sometime in the early 20th century, a style of music emerged and got the name jazz. What made it different from what had come before? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How did jazz piano, once considered less than respectable, enter the mainstream of American music? After the big band era, where did all those jazz pianists go, and what are the influences that shape jazz piano today? Our guest is Johannes Wallmann, jazz pianist and composer and director of jazz studies at the UW-Madison.
Well, welcome to University of the Year.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with what we just heard you play, sitting at the piano here, no music in front of you. It sounded like a riff on Gershwin's Summertime from Porgy and Bess. Help me understand how what you just did is nothing other than jazz.
Well, jazz has always been a hybrid music form. It's something that has combined elements of West African rhythmic influences, European harmonies, and so on. So really, I don't think we can tease out all those other influences. There are certainly other things in that. But at the core of it, it certainly is both a jazz composition, as Gershwin intended it, and a jazz performance, and that almost all components of what I played had some element of improvisation to them. So there was improvisation in terms of what we sort of conventionally think of jazz improvisation, new melodies that you haven't heard on that piece before, sort of a linear thing. Yeah, and that's a new melody. That's not the melody of Summertime, but it's kind of it's an improvisation based on the underlying harmonic progression. But then other elements of it that are more or less improvised are also my particular harmonic approach to the piece, which might change from one performance to the next, although there'll probably be some common elements as well. So the melody starts with, and we expect to hear some kind of chord with that. And that chord could be played any number of ways. So, every performance is going to have a somewhat different chordal structure to it. And they, of course, all contain common elements. What happens in terms of the bass notes in the left hand? Again, that's improvised to some degree. So that's kind of the core of jazz. And then the improvisation uses elements of jazz. It's a little bit like telling a story where we know the story beforehand. And I'm not really inventing new words to tell the story. The words already exist. And we kind of have a common grammar that we use. The syntax is more or less a given. But then how the story is told is always going to involve some different words and some different ways of putting those sentences together. And in this case, you asked me to play for about 60 seconds, so it's going to be a very different performance than if you gave me 3 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever the case may be.
All right, well, let's call you on that and say, if you were to give us another 60-second rendition of Summertime, right off the top of your head, what would you come up with?
And in a very different way than the one we heard.
That would be different from what you gave us before.
All right. So if I'm that is an interesting challenge because that last one was kind of very much intended for this specific situation. So now I might want to think of taking myself out of this situation and imagine myself in a different place. So maybe in a place where I'm trying to get people to tap their feet a little bit more, I might start the tune with something a little bit more groovy, like a and then, of course, you're going to want to hear some melody in there.
Thank you.
so on.
Well, certainly different, but yet, as you say, it's the same. And I gather pianists, more than other jazz performers, really have to rely on their own inventiveness to set themselves apart from other pianists.
Yeah, we have to do it in a different way from other instrumentalists. You know, a lot of my colleagues who play, say, the drums seem to be on this never-ending quest for new gear. They always, every time they're in a new town, they hit the local drum store and check out the cymbals, which, you know, it seems like, okay, it's just a round piece of metal. How different can one cymbal be from another? But they really do have an incredible amount of characteristic to them. And as a pianist, I don't travel with my own gear. So I'm very much dependent on whatever I find, which sometimes is just tremendous. I, you know, show up at a concert hall, and it's a piano that I could never in my lifetime afford to own. So I'm very happy to play that. And then maybe the next day, I'm at a nightclub, and the piano is, you know, one step up from firewood,
and out of tune,
and maybe a couple of keys don't even work, mm-hmm. which is, you know. That's one of those situations that's far from ideal, but, you know, pushes you to figure out ways around it. And again, that's, you know, the improvisation there is going to be based on the situation that you're in. It may not be an ideal situation, but sometimes, you know, you end up coming up with creative solutions. But in any given venue and any given piano, whoever is playing this piano that's right in front of me, you know, if you're going to have 10 different jazz pianists here playing this piano, we're all going to have a different sound, or we're all going to strive for a different sound, even though we're playing the same instrument. And we don't really get to do that so much through timbre alone, you know, the sound quality. Now, when you hear one saxophonist play a single note and then you hear a different saxophonist play a single note, chances are they'll sound quite different. They will have worked very hard in their musical development to develop their own sound. While as a pianist...
Not much you can do.
There's not much you can do with a single note. So developing your own technique becomes about the relationship between notes. How, you know, if you put two notes next to each other, will they both have equal weight? Will they both be equally loud? How do you connect them with sound? And again, two notes doesn't give you a whole lot to work with yet. But the beauty of the piano, of course, is that we can play a whole lot of notes at the same time. So how you voice the chords, which notes you choose to play in a chord, and which notes you play in a line, and how you choose to articulate those notes, hopefully gives every pianist a very unique character.
Well, let's look at some contrast in style then. There are scads of pianists throughout the 20th century and now early into the 21st that we could look at. And so, of course, we'll be skipping over some great ones for the sake of getting to some others. But one of the greatest was Duke Ellington.
Yeah, and we think of him, you know, first and foremost as a composer and a band leader, and oftentimes he's a little bit neglected as a pianist. He was also as a band leader very much, you know, a showman, as, you know, as any band leader really needs to be to captivate an audience. And so sometimes we, you know, kind of just remember him as a conductor and forget what a terrific pianist he was. But he did, of course, play on his own albums, and then. I like this particular recording a lot because in the early 1960s, he made a trio album with some very modern players. And Duke Ellington never shied away from new situations. And so he put himself in the situation recording with Charles Mingus and Max Roach, who were, you know, younger players than him and more maybe avant-garde at the time, more adventurous players. And Duke Ellington just really rose to the occasion and recorded this terrific album called Money Jungle.
So if we listen to this track from Duke Ellington's Money Jungle, what characteristics do you think kind of establish his voice as a jazz pianist?
You know, I think what you can hear in there is very much his voice as a jazz pianist and as a composer. And of course, that makes sense that as pianists, we think about harmony in a very direct way in terms of how to distribute multiple notes around the keyboard. And then as band leaders, we think about how to, as composers for a big band, you would think about how to distribute those notes around the orchestra. So there's an orchestral element to his playing. I think that is very much represents Duke Ellington's compositional voice as well as his piano voice. Yeah, something about this particular track that really appeals to me is that on the one hand, it doesn't have an overt element that we normally associate with jazz, which is swing. It's, you know, the eighth notes in that track aren't swung. They're, you know, in the jazz world we refer to as straight eighth notes, an even division of the beat, one and two and three and four and one, yeah, as opposed to one and two and three and four, that more syncopated style of playing. Yet the same elasticity that's connected, you know, with swing playing is very much in this recording, in that all three players take enormous liberties with the beat and yet always find their way back together, you know, throughout that performance. And another element that's very much at the core of jazz is the blues. And the harmonic progression underlying this composition is a blues progression. And yet it's not very overt in terms of how it's presented. It certainly doesn't sound like a classic blues as we imagined it maybe 10, 20 years earlier.
Langston Hughes talks about in his first book of jazz that jazz is the first uniquely American music to come along, because you have the fusion of the African rhythms and then the European harmonies with African American music that broke new ground.
Right, and let's not forget the Hispanic and Cuban influence in the music as well, because really initially jazz grew up, came about in New Orleans, and New Orleans as a port town very much had that Caribbean connection as well. And those three elements, those are the building blocks of jazz. And of course, those elements existed in quite a few places in the Americas. They existed in Cuba. They existed in Brazil. So in Colombia. So there are quite a few different musical cultures throughout the Americas that have African American musics. And jazz is the U.S. is one of the U.S. American forms of that. Blues, of course, is as well.
Does ragtime fit into that picture at all as a kind of a precursor of jazz?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
and it had European influences, because John Philip Sousa was influenced by the German marches of the 19th century, and that finds its way into ragtime, and then ragtime feeds mm-hmm. back into American jazz.
Yeah, in the end, musicians, we listen to everything around us, and if something is appealing and interesting, then somebody's going to grab it and try to figure out how to incorporate that.
Where did then Thelonious Monk's style come from?
Oh, that is a wonderful question, because he was really one of the great innovators of this music. And certainly, the influences of other pianists, that came before him in his music, Jelly Roll Morton, mm-hmm. for example. But Thelonious Monk is one of those players that really does make you ask, did he come from? Because he had such a unique sound, such a unique musical personality, that in many ways his influences in jazz, I think his most lasting influence is that of this just incredibly creative personality. Oftentimes, trying to take a specific phrase, a specific lick from Thelonious Monk and try to copy that lick isn't as effective as just simply the inspiration of saying, well, how did he let his personality come out so strongly in his music and develop his own sound?
Before we hear an excerpt from Thelonious Monk, what should we listen for as we hear it?
Phrasing, the rhythm in this. Once again, a different rhythm from Duke Ellington. A sort of, we use the word syncopation a lot in jazz, and rarely do we really agree what it means. Swing or ragged rhythms and so on, and we really don't have the same sophisticated language to talk about rhythm that we do about harmony, because frankly, in music studies, we've had a lot longer time to develop a vocabulary to talk about harmony and melodic development. So to some degree with rhythm, we've always just kind of said, well, just listen and you'll get it. And I think there's something to that here. But certainly the teacher and academic in me thinks of that as a little bit of a cop-out. And it is a vocabulary I think we need to build over time. But if you listen to the rhythm here, I think you will hear something pretty special.
And swing is in the title.
And this is a particular kind of swing. This is Bemsha swing.
Bemsha swing. Bemsha referring to just the style of that Thelonious Monk composition? Improvisation? And to what extent, before we get into some other pianists, to what extent would these be improvised and to what extent actually charted?
Again, there's an underlying melody, the sort of musical story of... And then sort of a rough harmonic sketch underneath it. The harmonic progression for this is called a turnaround, which is basically a little harmonic progression that starts in your home key. And then sort of does a quick little circle back to the key that we started in. And that could be voiced... with more typical jazz voicings. And what Thelonious Monk here brings to the table, too, is some pretty powerful reharmonization, taking those same chords and substituting. Some versions of alternate chords into that progression. And which alternate chords are going to happen? I think that's part of the improvised component of that. And certainly, once you stop hearing... Once that melody is done, the rest of the melodic material is improvised as well.
More on modern jazz piano when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Johannes Wallmann, and he's taking us into the world of jazz piano, particularly in the later years of the 20th century and early into the 21st. One of those pianists that, unlike, say, Duke Ellington, is really known for being a pianist foremost is Oscar Peterson.
Yeah, and I'd be remiss not to bring up Oscar Peterson, because I grew up in Canada, and he is a national hero in Canada. He was born in Montreal, and as a musician growing up in Canada, you cannot get around Oscar Peterson, and deservedly so, because he's really and just an unbelievable player. Maybe not as much of an innovator as Duke Ellington and Thelonious Monk, who we just listened to, but somebody who just synthesized what was happening in the world of jazz piano and perfected it in a to a degree that is just magic. It's magical. Hearing him play, those of us who got to watch him play were always amazed by how effortless he would make it seem.
How was he trained classically first?
Yeah, he was. He had a lot of classical training, and like many of the early major figures in jazz as an African-Canadian musician, wouldn't have had access to the world of classical music performance opportunities, as composers, performers, a lot of African-American musicians gravitated to jazz, both because it spoke to them in terms of the culture in which they grew up, but also because their other opportunities were very much limited. So it was a field where they could thrive and find a niche for themselves.
So we take a standard here, Days of Wine and Roses, Oscar Peterson, and what's he going to bring to it?
He's going to bring a really nice arrangement. Oscar Peterson worked for a long time with a trio with Ray Brown and Ed Thigpen on bass and drums, respectively. He worked even longer in the trio with Ray Brown and a couple of different guitarists. So the chemistry between the three players here is just fabulous. And the other thing you're going to hear here is just a wonderfully light, effortless sense of deep swing. So this is something that we can that we heard Duke Ellington and Thelonious Monk do their versions of, and here it's Oscar Peterson going sort of right to the center of, I think, what defines swing rhythm.
In that version of Days and Wine and Roses, how important is the trio configuration there with the bass and the drums?
Oh, it's absolutely crucial. And you heard there one of the great bass players in jazz playing too, Ray Brown, one of the most swinging bass players. And this trio would not have sounded the same without the great Ray Brown on the bass. As a piano player, I'm always in a much better mood when I'm playing with a wonderful bass player. And it's no accident that when you search out the great pianists in jazz, you usually find right next to them the great bass players, because we just so depend on their harmonic sensibility, their sense of swing, their sense of groove, and then very much their ability to fill in that bottom half of the piano, where if we were playing solo piano, it'd probably be our left hand right there. So to some degree, we expect the bass player to take the place of much of what we do with our left hand, but maybe do it even more creatively than we would have thought of.
Well, another one is Bill Evans, and he had quite the solo career too, didn't he, as well as playing in
He most certainly did, but probably his most influential contributions to this music were in the trio format as well. Now, with Oscar Peterson, you heard a working trio that was together for a long time, and I think we're about to listen to a Bill Evans trio, one of the classic Bill Evans trio recordings. He also had a working band, but unfortunately with another great bass player in this music, Scott LaFaro, who unfortunately passed away just a few weeks after this recording was made. You know, what is an occupational hazard for touring musicians in a car accident after a late night after a gig? And we don't know what might have become of this band had they been able to stay together for a decade. But they did make some really, really classic recordings. And a real difference between these two trio formats that we just listened to is the conversational aspect. That in the Oscar Peterson version of Days of Wine and Roses, it's terrific, but much of it is has been worked out ahead of time, how the three instruments work together. While in this next piece, it's going to be very much an exploration of, you know, the players going into it with maybe less of an agenda of how the piece will develop and discovering it as they're playing it.
So this is Glorious Step by Bill Evans from 1961.
So the jazz trio really kind of became an established form, didn't it, with that combination, piano, bass, and drums?
Yeah, piano, bass, and drums. Early on, we often also heard piano, bass, and guitar, Nat King Cole, Oscar Peterson, and so on. But the drums more and more have given pianists a chance to both have a harmonic partner in the bass and then have a rhythmic partner in the drums, in a way that really speaks to the nature of the piano as this hybrid instrument of a string instrument, and our classical colleagues oftentimes emphasize that aspect of the instrument as a string instrument, and then we very much usually think of the instrument as a percussion instrument.
Yes,
hammers hitting strings, and it's really both. And so playing with another string player and another percussion player is just sort of seems to work out just great.
Do you still run into stereotypes about jazz players as somehow, you know, showing up late, maybe being a little drunk, and somehow not being in the center of a music school but on the margins?
You know, I've lived in the jazz world for so long where we know that those stereotypes at some point existed, and we know that they really don't describe us these days, that I don't really encounter that much. I think our classical colleagues have very much, it's a very different generation today. After, you know, decades of playing this music on such a high caliber, and I think there's a lot of respect for what we do. I certainly hope so.
You'd see, interestingly, I think more so than with classical music, maybe it's common in rock, but not as obvious, the same person kind of moving from one trio to another, like Ron Carter, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. And and that can be both a blessing and a curse for the music. Unfortunately, because of really mostly economics, it's been very, very challenging for musicians to keep one band together. Record labels, which until recently were very influential in terms of what music got recorded, and they're losing a lot of importance because they simply don't have the economic clout that they used to. But record labels typically, after after a musician had made two or three albums with the same band, would say, okay, well, the next album, we need some kind of hook to sell that, to make somebody want to buy the new album. So how about you bring in some new musicians to play with? Or some musicians were given the freedom to, work with their regular band, and then the producers would suggest, why don't you do an album of with a specific theme, like the music of Cole Porter or something. But even musicians like John Coltrane, were given strong suggestions to maybe make an album with Johnny Hartman. And let's do an album with a singer, which, Coltrane was such a, well, everybody involved with that album were such phenomenal musicians that worked out great. But it makes it difficult sometimes for musicians to keep their bands together, to market the same concept year after year. It's not just a problem with the record labels, but when you go play jazz festivals, how's your project this year different from the project we booked last year? And often we would like to just answer with, well, it's gotten 1 year better because we've had more chance to develop chemistry. But that's a tough way. That's a tough way to go. And you mentioned before, the classical music world, and the classical music world has been much more successful for a long time now than jazz to figure out a way to to subsidize performances and recordings through grants, through government support, through through private donations, and so on. So typically, when you go see a concert at, say, a concert hall, typically the cost of a ticket maybe covers half of the cost of putting on the performance. Mm-hmm. While jazz very often is expected to break even, to be commercially viable. Yeah, and that puts jazz players in a difficult situation where they oftentimes really are a little bit more at the mercy of the market forces, of the suggestions of a record label or a festival. But it's also a nice opportunity because essentially when we play music, we're having a musical conversation, as Bill Evans did. And sometimes the most interesting conversations are with people that you just met.
Norman mentioned Ron Carter. I see that the next two excerpts that you have him in the band for both. Can you set up the first one?
I wanted to bring in music of a player that's been a huge influence of mine, McCoy Tyner. And something that McCoy Tyner brings to the table here is a very muscular sense of piano playing. He was the pianist in John Coltrane's quartet for about 5 years. And there he had to compete with the huge sound that John Coltrane had on the tenor saxophone and the huge sound that Elvin Jones would create on the drums, and somehow still, be heard and be relevant in that music. So he really found a way to play not just loud in terms of individual notes, but to develop a big sound in terms of the chord voicings, develop a big sound in terms of his lines, and a really just powerful musical personality. This is from his own album for Blue Note Records entitled The Real McCoy. It shows McCoy Tyner as a band leader trying to develop developing his own personality by not having John Coltrane be the front person, but at the same time working with somebody with some similar influences. So it's Joe Henderson on the tenor saxophone here, Elvin Jones on drums, and Ron Carter on the bass, and this is Passion Dance. Thank you.
Well, he certainly is, what shall we say, doing his utmost to stay in the mix there, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
How would, as long as we have Ron Carter as our bassist in a trio, how would somebody like McCoy Tyner compare with Herbie Hancock, who is a aggressive a player, do you think, as McCoy Tyner?
Now, Herbie Hancock is a really interesting figure who I've spent a lot of time studying and listening to. Herbie Hancock is a really interesting player to my ears because he really synthesizes the style of a lot of different pianists who come before him. Yeah, he is influenced by the swing and the lines and the rhythms of Red Garland and of Wynton Kelly and of Bill Evans, all of whom were pianists who preceded him in Miles Davis's band. So he's kind of the perfect fit for Miles's band by the time he joined that band in 1964. He also, as a very young player, played with Benny Goodman, and he played with Eric Dolphy, and he played in the Latin jazz scene. And at a very young age, he sort of became the in-demand player on the New York scene for just about anyone who could get him into their band or on their recording project. They would, because he was able to just keep his own musical personality, but adapt it in such a way that it would fit just great into lots and lots of different situations. Now, in Herbie Hancock, this next track has Herbie Hancock playing in a group with Ron Carter on the bass, and Ron Carter was the bassist in Miles Davis's band at the time as well. So Herbie, for a solo project here with players who he otherwise hadn't worked with that much, gravitated towards having a bass player on that recording that he had lots of chemistry with from having worked with him in Miles's band. This is an album called Speak Like a Child, and I think it's something that appeals to a lot of jazz pianists. You know, we oftentimes find ourselves, by the nature of the instrument, in a situation where, you know, we're considered the accompanist to whoever the star is. And here, Herbie Hancock put together a sextet album with three horn players, flugelhorn, alto flute, and trombone, piano, bass, and drums. And it turns out the only soloist on the entire album is Herbie Hancock. yet the other players all play a very important role as part of the compositions that he wrote for the album. And this piece is entitled Toys.
That was Toys with Herbie Hancock. More on jazz piano when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Johannes Wallman, and we are talking about the modern jazz piano. So far, everything we've heard is without plugging it in. Is that something that jazz resists more than rock?
Well, it very much depends on the player. So myself, I really understand myself as a pianist and not as a keyboard player. So while very occasionally you might see me on a keyboard if the situation absolutely requires it, there are certainly pianists who jumped on the opportunity to develop the new sounds that synthesizers opened the door for. Herbie Hancock actually is a prime example of that. Back in 1969, started experimenting with electric pianos, early synthesizers, and Herbie was a tinkerer and a who always had an interest. Actually, studied electrical engineering in college before he changed his major to music, and really was happy to get into those early synthesizers with a screwdriver and with patch cords and so on. And if I have this correct, I believe his Headhunters band was the first band to go on the road with synthesizers, which at the time were giant clunky machines that would break all the time, were difficult to keep in tune. So he actually had a keyboard technician who traveled with the band. So it was certainly of a lot of interest to players, and some stuck with it and others said, no, I'm really more of a pianist.
What about Chick Corea?
Well, Chick was another one of the early adapters of synthesizer technology and really one of the giants in that field. Now, I brought in a recording of Chick Corea in a fusion setting, and really synthesizers never really created much of a niche for them in swing jazz playing, but became a major component of jazz fusion. And Chick's band, Return to Forever, Herbie Hancock's Headhunters band, and Joe Zawinul's Weather Report. Here, you know, this is three of probably the four or five great fusion bands of the 1970s, and they're led by piano players / keyboard players. But since we were talking about jazz piano, I wanted to bring an example of Chick Corea working in that kind of setting, but still playing the piano. And I really love the fact that he always keeps the piano kind of at the center of what he does. So this is an album with the late Michael Brecker on tenor saxophone, Eddie Gomez on bass, and Steve Gadd on drums. It's entitled Three Quartets.
By the time we get to the career of Chick Corea, we have new influence in jazz coming from Europe.
Yeah, and European audiences and musicians have always been interested in jazz, going all the way back to the beginnings of recorded music. Certainly those recordings traveled to Europe and Japan and around the world and found a receptive audience. But for quite a few decades, European musicians and other international music scenes would essentially, were very interested in jazz, but would essentially try to copy exactly what was going on in the U.S. And one of the challenges with copying anything in jazz is that it's music that's really about, you know, individual personalities trying to not copy what happened before. As one of my teachers told me when I was in college, is don't try to copy me. I'm always going to be the best at being me.
Right.
And which was good advice. And it was really in the early 1970s that Scandinavian musicians in Europe really first developed a sound that was quite different from a jazz sound that was quite different from what's going on in the U.S. And I think they really very much enjoyed the music coming from the U.S. You know, this music that at the time was very much music coming out of small clubs in New York City, you know, that had the vibe of an intense, vibrant metropolis, maybe didn't quite describe their own experience of life living in a vast, beautiful country with fjords and tall mountains and, and a very serene and tranquil kind of experience.
You've brought in an excerpt called Dodge the Dodo from 2000. Set that up for us.
So this is a piece by the Esbjørn Svensson trio. So I fast forward a few decades, and this is from, I think it was recorded in the year 2000. And Esbjørn Svensson has become, at the time, he passed away recently, but became one of the key figures in European jazz. And one of the things that this band does is, the band is called EST, the Esbjørn Svensson Trio. And they're, on the one hand, sort of a classic jazz piano trio, piano, bass, and drums, but they also bring some electronic influences to their music, in part on how the piano is recorded. So there's some new recording technology at work. And this is very much also the music of a generation that grew up not only on jazz, but on drum and bass and techno and a lot of other influences as well. So you hear some of that in here as well.
So if that's Scandinavian jazz, what excites you now if you just think about jazz globally?
You're right. Jazz has become this incredibly global art form that is still very much rooted in the African-American experience and tradition. And yet musicians from all over the world have picked up on that and found a way to identify with that and to bring their own personalities and cultural identities into that music as well. And that's happening around the world, and it's also very much happening here at home. And I wanted to bring in one more example that sort of exemplifies that. And, of course, there's so many different wonderful pianists right now bringing together global influences. It's very difficult to pick one example, but hopefully inspire people to check out some other things. This is a pianist by the name of Vijay Iyer. And Vijay's family background is South Indian, but he is, you know, he's certainly American-born and grew up with lots of American influences, but also through his family, some South Indian influences, and the South Indian influence, he has very much a rhythmic sensibility to South Indian classical music. It's highly complex in terms of its rhythmic patterns, so he brings that to the table, and he plays with a bunch of other New York musicians who, this is another band, this is another group of musicians who have been together as a band for quite a while and who've developed the sound together.
Thank you.
Well, it still sounds like jazz, doesn't it? It's still jazz, but there are some other things going on top.
You know, I think I still want to tap my feet to it, but I'm sometimes not quite sure how to. So, yeah, we're trying to, in some ways, it's always been music that wanted to make you move. And I think this music still wants to make me move. But there's a degree of complexity in some of the modern music that really draws on this rich history of the music now and a rich history of music from all over the globe.
Now, you've recorded some jazz, and how would you characterize your own work?
Again, eclectic, drawing on a lot of different influences, trying to keep the rhythm of it at the center. A lot of my influences really lie in some of this music from the 1960s that we listened to, McCoy Tyner, Bill Evans, Herbie Hancock. And I'm trying to essentially do a modern take on that. I don't think my music sounds like the 1960s, but it draws heavily on those influences.
And as we go out on one of your recordings, Loving Day, let me thank you, Johannes Wallman, for being our guest on University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, and hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.